heaven pleasing to all mankind. Understanding and peace in mind. But if it's not asking too much, please send me someone to love. Someone to love. Show the world how.
And you are listening to C, or the Radio Regent. And I'm at Lowe. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right, I'm speaking with Amit Lowe from the Group for Research and Initiative for the Liberation of Africa, GRILA. And African Liberation Day 2013 is going to be taking place very, very soon. And you are holding an event next week at a different book lists. Could we talk about the event Saturday, May 25th from 5 to 7 p.m. And a different book list is at 746 Bathurst Street, south of Bloor. And the topic, I guess, is Pan-Africanism and today's challenges, obstacles, and ways forward. And I think there are two speakers, Amit Lowe and Pablo Idahoza. Am I correct in what I just said?
Yes, you're correct. That's right.
Okay, let us talk about African Liberation Day in Toronto. Now, in 1972, African Liberation Day was celebrated in Toronto, in Washington, D.C., and in San Francisco, in Jamaica, Grenada, Guyana, and all of the personalities that became world figures participated in 1972. Walter Rodney, I believe, was in San Francisco. Morris Bishop was in Grenada. EUC Guyana, and were in Guyana, and Fania Davis, Angela Davis's sister, was here in Toronto, and I think Rap Brown's brother was here in Toronto. So you're carrying on a tradition, but I just wanted to get you to let people know why they should even support African Liberation Day.
Yes, I would like to start by thanking you first with Regent Park for giving us this opportunity to come and discuss about this very important commemoration, as you mentioned, which is a long time event that has been happening both in the African continent and in the black diaspora across the world. And it was initiated in 1958 in the city of Accra, Ghana, with African leaders and political activists that gathered at the first conference of independent African state. And at the time, it was attended by representatives of multiple governments from Ethiopia, Ghana, Liberia, and so on and so forth. And since then, the event has been spreading, and then every year, it is an opportunity for people of African descent from wherever they live to come together to reflect on what has been achieved from 1958 to today, because there have been some achievements, but also to think about some of the major obstacles and the major threats that are threatening to roll back some of the gains that have been achieved through a long process of national liberation that was led by national liberation movement across the continent, to have at least moved out from former colonialism to a new stage of former independence. Now, what for this year specifically, it is the event going to be celebrated in the specific particular context worldwide that is very very, very, very important to understand if you have to make a good contribution to what we are trying to reflect on. If you notice that there have been a recent crisis in Mali that has caught the world attention recently, and issues at play in the West African region, just to take that example, the Sahel and beyond are not only many, but are very complex issues. And in addition, they involve diverse actors at the national, regional, and international level. So if we are not to be trapped behind what I call a fragmented vision, one that only focuses on specific areas of the West African region, for example, as if they exist in isolation, our analysis must be, in fact, be rigorous and very consistent. In fact, it must be of necessity connect the multiple dimension of the present crisis, which within the global context comes under the umbrella of a project that is more or less aiming at controlling all that vast region called Africa, an area that undoubtedly will be of supreme importance in terms of satisfying expanding imperialist appetites for decades to come. So that's the current context that we are going through today. And if you notice, in today's the world capitalist system is kind of appear to be entering yet another phase of what can be termed as a global redeployment. 50 years after the proclamation of flat independence, of course, by deepening the process of decolonization, the renewed African masses are at a juncture where they are trying to make attempts to kind of, in a way, recapture the success of the earlier leap forward. Of course, the different crises that we witnessed in Mali, in Libya, and in other areas remind us of the challenges ahead and also offers fresh opportunities for re-energizing the historical project that was called the political unification of the African continent. So the reason I'm mentioning this, all these issues is that we have to locate to this year's commemoration of the African Liberation Day within the larger global context of the imperialist project of redeployment that's going to be happening, and this is currently happening in Africa, and which is more or less basically at recapturing freely the vast natural resources that are existing inside the continent, the mining resources and the land that is going to be used for agriculture. And that's one of the driving forces that is behind the dual aspect of the issue, which is the issue of militarization. Because these two issues are, in a way, dialectically linked, because one is fueling the others. Because in order for the militarization process to create the condition to facilitate this land grab and resource grab, the militarization process have to go further and further. And that's why you have noticed for the last couple of years a big push from the United States trying to relocate their AFRICOM military system, which is currently based in Germany, Stuttgart, to move that entity inside the African continent to have legal foot on the ground.
Can I ask you a question?
Further that process of militarization.
Can I ask you a question, Amit? I want to ask you a question about the fact that I wanted you to point out the fact that AFRICOM has not been able to, no African country to this point has allowed AFRICOM to have a base in Africa. That's why they're in Germany. Could you elaborate on that and then continue your point?
Yes, so far they have made a lot of contacts. And so far, as of today, there is not one single country that have accepted openly, officially to receive that military base called AFRICOM. That's why, as we speak, it's still located in Germany, in Stuttgart. But the United States have, however, signed some partial deal, bilateral deals with some countries that allow them some preliminary presence in their territory, awaiting a larger redeployment of the whole base from Germany to Africa. You can notice, for example, that they have some special forces operating from Uganda and Central African Republic. They have recently they have a base for from where they can operate their drones in Niger, which is close to Mali, and it's being operational. So what is important to notice here is that at one point, I believe United States will manage to make a deal with one country on a bilateral basis. So to prevent that, we are suggesting that the whole issue of the presence of the military bases in Africa have to be dealt with at the global level, either at the level of the African Union or at least at the regional level, ECOWAS or the Southern African Development Community, to develop a common position at the regional level, at least, that the presence of foreign military bases in Africa is unacceptable in 2013. If not, if that does not happen, it's most likely that one country at one point will have their leaders corrupted and accepting to accept the AFRICOM. Now, that doesn't solve the fundamental issue because the United States, I'm sure today, have the possibility to have that deal signed with one country, but they are focusing more on specific countries which have a very high strategic value. So in the West African region, where they would like to have, what the potential country that they are aiming at
is Nigeria,
Mali, because of the strategic region of the Sahel, from mm-hmm. where they can be able to control the whole Sahel region, going stretching from Mali all the way to Libya, that large zone that they call NENA, which is North Africa, Middle East, is a geographical region that they have in the concept of controlling the African continent. That's why there has been this dividing roles being played between AFRICOM on the one side and NATO, trying to recapture totally that whole region located in the Sahel, stretching all the way up to Libya, Egypt, Algeria, and Tunisia.
So you're saying that Mali is more of a prize to U.S. imperialism than Nigeria. Now, some people argue that, you know, Nigeria has oil and so on and so forth, but you're saying that's for strategic, because of Mali is located where it is. It is Mali that's the big prize that they want. That's the number one prize. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons. That doesn't mean that they don't have an eye on areas like Nigeria. But I believe that because Mali is a weaker country and also which is called to the Sahara, and which is a location where that can allow them to control that whole Sahel region. I believe in terms of a location of a military base, they seem to be favoring more Mali because they might believe that maybe they have a better chance to have it located there than in Nigeria, which is a little bit more unstable right now because of the what they call Boko Haram and the non-functioning of the Federation there that hasn't created a condition of stability. But the vision that is behind the deployment of AFRICOM is not to look only in the situation of Mali, but the whole African continent. But in terms of physical location of the base, Mali is one of the choices, which is not the only choice, but it's one of the options they are looking at right now.
All right, I'm speaking with Ahmet Low. He's with the Group for Research and Initiative for the Liberation of Africa, GRILA, and African Liberation Day 2013 will be taking place in Toronto. An event to support African Liberation Day will be taking place next Saturday, May 25th, between 5 and 7 p.m. at a different book list. That's at 746 Bathurst Street, south of Bloor. Now, some have maintained that Pan-Africanism is the concept of Pan-Africanism. Some have said that Pan-Africanism is the unification of the African continent. And some have argued that Pan-Africanism is the African people wherever they are. Many have argued that Trinidadians have been, you know, very important in the whole concept of Pan-Africanism. H. Sylvester Williams, who held the first Pan-African conference in 1900, he is, by some say, is the father of Pan-Africanism. And then Du Bois came along with the Pan-African Congresses from, I guess, 1905 until 1945. The point I'm making is that Pan-Africanism in 2013, does your organization and yourself see Pan-Africanism as a continental movement, or is it a worldwide movement?
Pan-Africanism has always been, since its inception, a worldwide movement because, as you mentioned, the first inspiration to the Pan-Africanist movement did not come really from the continent, but rather from the black diaspora, with, you mentioned the case of Trinidad, with people like George Padmore and Celia James, who play a big role in helping organize the Manchester Conference, Pan-African Conference. Earlier, before that, you have the influence that Marcus Garvey have played in terms of influencing a whole range of African leaders, African from the continent, I mean, in terms of pushing forward the agenda of national liberation and moving forward out of colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
So from its inception, Pan-Africanism have received a great contribution from its black diaspora, in the black diaspora. And what is a little bit still ongoing is that there is a need to still reinforce that historical link that ties together these two components that are inseparable, which is the African people from the continent and the people of African descent living from the diaspora in Latin America, in Brazil, in Mexico, in the Caribbean, in North America,
in the South Pacific.
In the South Pacific, all
right.
Those areas, I think, believe there is still a need to reinforce those historical links through a process, not only from an abstract level, but through a process of political struggle, because today the objective condition in which we are all living as black people is very similar wherever we are, in the Bronx or in Soweto or in Brazil. The physical condition under which we live and the situation of oppression and poverty that ties us together represent what I can call as the minimum basis of unity for our people to move forward.
Let me ask you, this is a kind of important question. Pan-Africanism is the economic system that people are going to talk about in Pan-Africanism. I think that there's a wing of the movement that says that capitalism, and I think Du Bois made this point very clear, that capitalism was a system that enslaved us, so therefore we can't support capitalism as an economic system. But in the Pan-African world, we have, say, the liberation theology folks, we have Muslims and we have socialists, and the socialists are Marxists of all stripes, and we have a situation where the Islam is being, you have a progressive wing of Islam, then you have a wing of Islam that is definitely is being used by imperialism. Could you talk about the whole question of capitalism versus socialism and the competing ideologies that are trying to win support or trying to liberate Africa and Africans, pardon me?
Yes, I mean, when you look at the two main teams that were used for this year's celebration of African Liberation Day is the dual issue, what we call the dual issue between, on the one side, the question of resource grab, which implies the natural resources like mines and gold and copper, et cetera, et cetera. And agricultural land grab on the one side, and also the threat of militarization by imperialism on the other side. So when you look at those two issues, you see that that should help people to understand the forces that we are working against today in terms of recapturing our historical process of and our destiny. And those forces are forces of global capitalism and of imperialism even further. And I have no question about that, if one is serious in terms of pushing forward the agenda of African liberation, one cannot at the same time be in collusion with this project called the imperialist project that has been maintaining our people under domination for 500 years. Now, the economic questions, what I have to say about on that is that it has to be tied to the question of a political vision. What have handicapped, in a way, the process of unification in the continent that was led by institutions like the OAU or today the African Union, is that at one point people tend to have this dream that maybe we need to further develop the economic capacity of the of our people in order to gain our independence, and that is, I believe, not a correct analysis, because the economic approach, the economic vision that we have to use, have to come out of a political vision. And that's why I believe there is a supremacy of the political process of integration and a vision that has to set forward under which conditions the economy has to be built upon. So instead of trying to promote the idea of economic integration and then thinking that it might lead to political unification, it's the other way around. I think it's the political process of liberation that at one point will have defined vision, an economic vision for dealing with the issue of economy and the market forces. Right?
So you say, you're basically, in Krumah's thesis, you support Osagyefo, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah's thesis that seek ye first the political kingdom, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the political, in my sense, is have supremacy on all right. other aspects. And the same question was raised even in a lot of the national liberation movement. I heard on your show earlier someone talked about Amilcar Cabral, and he was one of the greatest revolutionaries the world have ever known recently, insisting on an ongoing basis on the necessity, for example, to subjugate the military or the state apparatus to the political vision of a movement that is fighting to free its people. So I believe that if you look at even the recent history of the European Union, that a lot of people tend to use as a model, which I'm not, but looks like they are hitting the same roadblock right now because they have put the priority on the question of building economic integration and the common market, etc. But right now, it's going back to bite them that the whole process of political unification of Europe should have been prerequisite to that process of economic integration and the creation of a common market.
So, we only have 4 minutes, and I wanted to say that I read a little bit of Marcus Mosiah Garvey, and I remember having this discussion with some young brothers who claimed to be Mark Garveyites, and they were defending capitalism as, you know, the way we Africans need to be capitalists. So I was telling them that if you read the philosophy and opinions of Marcus Garvey, he said that a capitalist, an individual capitalist, could only have $1 million, and a capitalist corporation could only have $2 million. Now, that means he would the capitalist individual capitalists and the corporations would hate Marcus Garvey, don't you think?
Yeah, and some people have the argument, but I believe what I'm saying usually to the people is that if Africa needs some kind of capitalist framework, as some people suggest, which I don't believe it should be a priority, we have to analyze to see what are the conditions that would allow capitalist system to emerge in Africa. Is it going to happen from the drop from the sky? I don't believe so. If we look at the history of China, for example, who is moving into a more mainstream type of market, oriented type of economy, to get to the point they have to go through
You're really cracking. It's very difficult to hear you. I think we're going to have to just let people come and hear you because we have definitely a problem with the phone. So I just want to let people know that they can catch you at a different book list next Saturday between 5 and 7 at a different book list. And I thank you for the interview. All right. Thank you. So take care of yourself. All right. And we have been speaking with Amit Low of the of Gorilla, and we're going to come back with you very, very shortly. Probably his phone.
Ishe Oluwa Kole Badeo. Ishe Oluwa Kole Badeo. Ishe Oluwa Kole Badeo. Ishe
Africa, a vast continent of many different people, customs, and languages. Ishe Oluwa Kole Baje is a song which has been passed down through generations among the Yoruba people of Nigeria, a country located in the western region of Africa. Often sung in church and on happy occasions, these words mean that God's work will never be destroyed.
Kole baje o, kole baje o, kole baje o, kole baje o. Ishe Oluwa, kole baje o, ishe. Ishe Oluwa Kole Baje o. Ishe Oluwa Kole Baje o. Ishe Oluwa Kole Baje o. Ishe Oluwa. Kole baje o, kole baje o. Oluwa.